It's on next Sunday.
You were right about the gingerbread.
Class?
It's on
I
Sunday.
Know.
Oh.
I can't miss.
What?
Because I don't want.
I know. I feel like I never see anyone anymore.
I'm sorry it's been so long. I'm
run past once in a while. And
it's okay, you're working.
You're
okay.
A little
I'm
usually
in here and tired.
I don't want anything else. But I like this.
Rabbi Bradowitz, would you like a cookie? You can check the head shape if you want.
Oh, no, okay, thank you. Thanks so much.
It's one of those Hebrew ones.
No, no, I trust anything you get. If it's in Hebrew, it's okay.
Oh, yes.
They're delicious. So sweet.
Can I have another one?
Are they? Wait, I'm play shape.
They're not. Let me double check.
I'm pretty
sure they're
Foolish woman. Don't things taste like porn?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll try one. They're totally Russian, Ukrainian.
They're so sweet. Can I have one more?
They're delicious.
You
love.
Just passed one over.
Thank you.
Can I have one more for dessert?
Yeah. One for the meal, one for dessert.
Awesome.
Yeah. These are amazing.
They are good.
You want to check the hash?
Right.
Is this like German?
I don't know.
German, Russian,
I know.
It's a good hash.
Yeah,
it's Hebrew.
Oh,
they're delicious. They're so delicious.
Oh, this is the things that we say.
Spelt?
Yes.
Spelt cookie? Yes, spelt cookie.
Yes.
Because if not, I'll eat them all.
Lena?
Yeah,
Lena?
Yes?
Love you.
Okay, good evening, everybody. How are you? And let me spend the first 5 minutes or so. I was going to ask you without thinking how was your Thanksgiving, but let me discuss for a brief halachic moment whether a religious Jew should observe Thanksgiving. It's an interesting halachic debate. I don't know what the Mayanot's position is on that officially. I don't know if Chabad
has a
position.
We're discarding it.
Okay, that's
we don't like it.
Okay.
We don't like the Mayanot position.
Their position is not to do anything. Yeah. Okay. I mean, is it neutral or against?
It's against.
Against.
Really?
Okay.
Okay.
Yes. So let me just explain. Let me just explain the issue. Again, just the issue, just so you know what the debate is. There is one of the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah, which is one of the 365 negative commandments, is b'chukoseihem lo seilechu. That means, do not walk in the laws or the statutes or the customs of the Gentiles. There's a general rule that we are not supposed to imitate what non-Jews do. Now, obviously, that doesn't apply to everything. I mean, we drive cars. We don't say, oh, they drove cars first, and Henry Ford was an anti-Semite for that matter, too. But primarily, it refers to the idea that practices and customs that had a religious origin in what non-Jews were doing to worship God, we are not supposed to appropriate and utilize. So at a minimum, if there are customs that were connected to idolatry, we're not supposed to follow them, even if we're not doing it for idolatrous reasons. So that's in the Torah, right? That's what the Torah says, do not walk in the ways of the Gentiles. So a major question that people raise is when you have, let's say, American holidays, which are presently secular holidays. You know, the government just lets people off, etc. But they had their origin in what is called Christian worship. Does it become tainted as following the ways of the Gentiles, or do I say it's become secular? Those who believe in something might go to church, but that's not necessarily the definition of the holiday itself. Unlike, for example, Christmas. Christmas has also become secular, but Christmas, by definition, is celebrating an event in the Christian religion. Thanksgiving, one could say, is it's an occasion to give thanks. Somebody gives thanks to Jesus. We can give thanks to Hashem, or we can whatever it would be. So the argument, so that's why there's a debate. There are some opinions, some rabbis who actually consider Thanksgiving to be a very, very good thing to celebrate, or at least a neutral. It's a time where family can get together. Others feel that because it had its origin as a Christian festival, going back to Jamestown or Plymouth Rock, or, you know, whatever it
would be. It wasn't religiously charged at all.
That's almost. I think that's very false. I think it's very, very clear that Thanksgiving was made to give that, unless you make it an Indian festival, which then turns into paganism and the like. So all I can tell you is there is a machlokas. There are different views about this. Some people feel Thanksgiving is an appropriate thing for a religious Jew to celebrate. Some people feel it is chukos hagoyim, the laws of the Gentiles. Now, the concept that some things that started off as idolatrous can become koshered, that's really the basis of a lot of things. For example, yoga. That people ask, and again, Chabad has certain positions on this, which might be stricter than the mainstream, but many people ask, can I do yoga since yoga was connected to Eastern religions and the like? And we basically say, even though it still is, if you're doing it just for the health benefits, for the stretching, for the relaxation, and your mantras, you don't use the mantras connected to the Eastern religions, you use the Shema or something else that could focus your mind. So it is a technique. As a technique, the fact that idolaters invented it or discovered it or figured it out does not make it puzzle. Now, it's a little more controversial when you move away from yoga to energy healing. Now, energy healing is very different because yoga can work on a strictly physical way, you know, stretching and bending. Energy healing involves the manipulation of what you might call intangible, almost mystical forces and the like. Now, there are many Balei Tshuva who came from Eastern religions, and they actually pursue, with the advice and consultation of rabbis, different types of energy healing and the like. You know, there are all sorts of different branches. In fact, in Israel, it's very popular. Every other person is studying or is an energy healer, whether it's whole brain, one brain, all sorts of different names.
But it's allowed in halacha?
So, again, many poskim have said that it is allowed in halacha because even the Eastern religions, let's say, that have identified chakras and the like, those are describing realities. The fact that they're metaphysical realities doesn't mean they're not realities. And therefore, if you can separate it from concepts of religious worship, but I say it's very, very dangerous because you're dealing with mystical, non-rational forces, and then you get into what Kabbalah calls the Sitra Achra, the other side. So it's very important that if somebody is fooling around, in other words, when somebody is simply fixing my back, I may not care if they believe in God or don't believe in God, as long as they know how to manipulate my back or give me medicine. But when somebody is fooling around with my spiritual dimension, I don't want somebody who has a different spiritual identity to be fooling around. So if you're going to energy healers or the like, you should try very hard to go to a religious observant Jew. Actually, Rabbi Levinger's wife is a very, very excellent, very well-known healer in Jerusalem. I don't know if you're aware of this, but she's one of the best. She's one of the best in the city. But you may not be able to afford her. But anyway.
No, my discount?
Well, maybe, yes. But this is an example of, you know, obviously a religious woman who knows how to use the technique. But as I say, when somebody is fooling around with your soul, you want to be sure that they're doing it with kedusha. It's very, very different than physical healings and the like. But that's the issue of Thanksgiving. Now, I remember when I was a student in the Neri Israel Yeshiva in Baltimore many, many years ago. So what the yeshiva used to do was, they would buy turkey around Thanksgiving time because it was cheaper, but they would not serve it until Shabbos. They would not serve it on a Thursday, they would serve it on Shabbos in honor of Shabbos and the like, because they didn't want to make a turkey meal in honor of an American holiday. Now, there's another bit of trivia. Do you know that there were a few families in Russia, and maybe they're still around, they did not eat turkey at all. They held that turkey was not a kosher bird, because there's a very unusual halacha by birds. The kashrus of birds is very different than the kashrus of other animals.
Tradition, right?
Right. The kashrus of other animals is defined objectively in the Torah. If it has a split hoof and it chews its cud, you can eat it. So even if we discover a new animal, as long as the new animal has split hoofs and chews its cud, it's going to be kosher. We don't need any tradition because we have the actual signs in the Torah itself.
But don't we not eat giraffe because there's no tradition for it?
Well, some people do eat giraffe. It doesn't taste that good.
What?
Yeah. Well, no, I didn't try. No. But this is a report that I read. So many people hold you can eat giraffe. You don't need a tradition. Now, the problem with giraffe is that, you know, the neck is so long, where do you shecht it? Yeah. You know, things like that. Now, with birds, fish, same thing. Fish have definitive signs. Scales and fins. So shellfish, no good. Lobster, no good, etc. But birds is more complicated. If you look in the Torah does not give you any signs for what is a kosher bird. It gives you a list of what is not kosher. And theoretically, most birds are actually kosher. But since we're so unsure what the ones that are not kosher are, we don't really know. So as a result, there is a general rule that we can only eat kosher birds, we can only eat birds if there is a long-standing tradition. Now, at some point, the tradition must have been invented. But in those days, if you go back far enough, they knew. But today, we really don't know what is a non-kosher bird, so unless there is a tradition, we do not eat it. So we have a tradition going all the way back to Chazal, that chickens, for example, are a kosher bird. Chickens have been around a very long time, so we have an unbroken tradition of 2,500 years that chickens are okay. But turkeys are much more recent. Turkeys are native North American. Right, so they didn't have turkeys in Europe until the 1700s. Yeah, so as a result, when turkeys were introduced, there were some rabbis who took the position that we don't have a tradition on a turkey. We have to treat it as a potentially non-kosher bird, because maybe it's one of the list. Other people say that it's so close to a chicken that you can draw an analogy, and they actually have a test. Their test is based on cross hybridization. That means if you have something you know for sure is kosher because you have a tradition, and you can mate it with something else and get an offspring, that's a sign that that's also kosher. In other words, they use cross hybridization as a test, and turkeys can be bred with chickens. I don't know what it's called.
A turkey
or something. I don't know what it is. Jerky. Okay, that's what it is. So there are some. So again, the minhag of Klal Yisrael is, by and large, that we do eat turkey. But there were some families in Russia that had a tradition not to eat turkey. Now, the issue of tradition also applies in another area of halacha. In addition to fish, animals, and birds,
locusts.
That's right. Locusts and grasshoppers. Certain of them are kosher, and certain of them are not kosher. And the Torah gives you certain signs as to what is a kosher grasshopper. But among Ashkenazim, we never had a tradition, so we don't eat any grasshoppers. But the Yemenites, the Taimanim, do eat kosher grasshoppers.
There's one type, right?
If you invite it over to a Seuda,
Yeah.
So this is
a big machlokas. In other words, there are many opinions that say that as long as an authentic Jewish community has a tradition, I am permitted to partake of it because they have a tradition. Others say that every community has to have its own tradition. So lemaisa, I would tell you that the halacha does allow you to eat the locust. In fact, you don't even have to be invited. In other words, you can go to the store and ask a teimoni, what do you, you know, who keeps halacha, mm-hmm. what do you buy? And you can buy it and have it in your own house as well. Yeah, I'm not sure if you'd want to do it. What do they say? They say on everything, the locust tastes just like chicken, whatever, you know. Whatever. No. They say everything tastes like chicken. That's what they say. Dog, you know, in China they give dog and rats and all the, everything tastes like chicken. But okay, yeah. So that's kind of the issues of Thanksgiving. Again, let me point out.
In that case, during Pesach, Ashkenazim can eat.
No. That's very different. That's very different.
Why?
No. The difference. Yeah, it's a very good question. I'm glad you asked it. The difference is this. If an Ashkenazi doesn't eat a grasshopper, that's only because we don't have the tradition, so we don't know. Mm-hmm. So if somebody who knows points it out to me, I'm allowed to eat. With kidneyot, it's not a question of not knowing. Ashkenazim hold that rice is forbidden during Pesach.
It's not a tradition?
It's a custom. It's not a Torah prohibition, mm-hmm. but the custom of Ashkenazim is this is a forbidden food.
Okay.
So if it is a forbidden food, so even if I'm invited to a Sephardi, I'm not allowed to eat a forbidden food.
Okay.
But the locust is not a forbidden food, it's just we lack the knowledge. So
what if
somebody
I marry
has
a Sephardi?
That's very different. That's a general rule. You may not like this rule, but the rule is a woman takes on the customs of her husband.
Whether she wants to or not.
In that case, it's a good thing. You get to have rice.
Can I ask the question then?
But the other way around, if you're a Sephardic woman who marries an Ashkenazi?
Yep. Well, you wouldn't do it.
You wouldn't do it? What do you mean you wouldn't do it? Why not? Yeah.
Is it possible, like, you know, with moving to marry? And I would say that from my perspective, because I don't know how difficult it would be for a Sephardi woman to marry an Ashkenazi and have Pesach.
Well, it happens.
Know.
It certainly happens.
But
this one did it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so if he would really insist to have kippurot, but you know, it's very hard to change someone's tradition. It's very hard to find to sit at a table.
Do they have a choice?
Can you cook whatever and just leave it to him and have potatoes?
You're talking about the wife is Ashkenazi.
Yes, I'm like,
why would you not want to eat?
It's hard. I don't know. It will take me time.
It's not a mitzvah to eat rice. I mean, if the woman is not comfortable. That's what I'm saying. If the woman is not comfortable in eating it, she doesn't have to eat it. She can make it for him if he wants and let him eat it. I mean, like anything else. It's not worse than something that the wife doesn't like, you know, so she. Now, the other way is also true, though. A husband can actually give his wife permission to keep her own custom. So if I'm an Ashkenazi, I can give my wife permission.
Write it down.
I know. Now, the reason why I call it permission is based on the principle that the minhagim of a house are the husband's minhagim. So the husband has to say.
Verbally? He
has to verbally say it's okay. Well, if it's understood, that he doesn't mind. This comes up a lot. Now, in the kitchen, it's difficult because the problem is, you see, if the wife is cooking stuff that the husband cannot eat, she may be making the kitchen treif. I mean, that is complicated. She'd have to have separate pots and pans for kidneys, and that is a very very important issue. But I'll give you an example where people can have different men.
What happened?
Hi. You look great.
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
It's just a very drastic and sudden change.
Is it
very drastic?
Is it
she
for me to ask?
She
I don't know.
Hair.
She got
a
hair.
Beautiful.
Oh, okay. Baruch Hashem. Okay.
Amazing.
Okay. Very nice. Okay. Now let me just say that this. So having different rules in the kitchen is theoretically possible, but it's very very difficult.
Yeah.
But I'll give you another example where it might be very common for the husband and the wife to have different minhagim, and that is, this may be something that will happen to you. Sitter. Let's say, you've, you know, let's say you daven Nusachari, you daven Chabad's sitter. or you daven Sephardic, or you daven Ashkenazi. And you marry a husband who does something different. The husband does Ashkenaz or Sfard, or the husband does Nisachari. But that's not the davening that you're used to. So although in theory you're supposed to change, but in practice it's certainly absolutely permissible. It's kind of just that you do your own thing because that's what you're used to. Same thing with pronunciations. If your pronunciation in Hebrew was Ashkenazis, like we say, Shabbos, whatever it is, you don't have to change to the Israeli. If it was Israeli, you don't have to change to the other pronunciation.
So I don't have to change my pronunciation?
I would not say that you do. Would someone tell you you should change your pronunciation?
I've been wondering about it because I grew up learning the Israeli pronunciation.
The Israeli pronunciation, right.
I know my grandparents grew up with Ashkenazi.
Well, the thing is this. The most important part of tefillah is, of course, kavana. Kavana is your intention and your feeling. So you should pray in the way that is most conducive to your kavana. So for most people, not for everybody, for most people, that's the way they're used to. Because if you have to make a conscious effort to change your pronunciations, that's a bit of a distraction. But, so I guess ideally it's good to link back to your grandparents and the like. Because, modern Hebrew pronunciation is really a fake language, really. It's not Sephardic either. It's closer to Sephardic than Ashkenazic, but it's not real Sephardic. It's not real Temani. It's really an amalgamation in some ways. So people, that's why some people don't even want to claim. The technical word for the Hebrew language is Lashon HaKodesh, the Holy Tongue. Mm-hmm. But some people make a big differentiation. They say Ivrit is not Lashon HaKodesh. Mm-hmm. Ivrit is a modern language that is connected to Lashon HaKodesh. Mm-hmm. And one can see a lot of words come from Lashon HaKodesh, but it is not the Lashon HaKodesh. Just to give you one example, take the word for electricity, right? What's the word for electricity? Chashmal. Chashmal. Now, chashmal is actually a word in Tanakh. It's a word in the Bible. It is describing the divine light and radiance that surrounds the Kisei HaKavod, the divine throne of God. It is the most elevated, bright light, right? We learned the Tanya talks about the Or Ein Sof, the light that comes from the infinite without limit. So, in the beginning of the 1900s, when Eliezer ben Yehuda, the founder of modern Hebrew, had to think of some word to describe electricity. Mm-hmm. Electricity is light, chashmal is light, we'll call it chashmal. I use the word chashmal. We all use the word chashmal, but it's almost sacrilegious.
Yeah.
You're taking the divine radiance of the Kisei HaKavod and you're applying it to a fluorescent light bulb? How can you talk that way? So there are some rabbis who do not use the word chashmal. They'll use the English word. They'll write it out in Hebrew letters. Electric. Ayin lamed, ayin kuf, Electric, because they think chashmal you cannot use. So, in many ways, modern Hebrew is not even a legitimate Torah language, but as I say, we're pretty lenient and we allow you to daven in the way that you were taught. When I was growing up, there still was an Ashkenazis Hebrew as a spoken language. Now it's extinct. Nobody speaks Ashkenazis Hebrew. Mm-hmm. Even though it's at least as old as Sephardic. It is as old as Sephardic, but it's not spoken anymore. Even in Mea Shearim, they'll speak Yiddish, but when they speak Hebrew, they'll speak Ivrit. Mm-hmm. Right? So I learned an extinct Hebrew that literally does not exist anymore. I mean, it exists in reading. Many people read Hebrew that way. But this was literally a spoken. I mean, when I was growing up, people still spoke Ashkenazis Hebrew. In fact, Rav Kook probably spoke Ashkenazis Hebrew, is my guess, although I never conversed with him, to my loss. Okay. All right, so that's just a little bit about Thanksgiving and about Minhagim and the like. Now, to go back to our main topic, I just wanted to finish up a little bit. We were talking about the very, very difficult problems, and God willing, you should all be spared these problems, of treating people towards the end of life when people have serious illnesses. They are close to death or they are suffering. How aggressive must we be to keep people alive no matter what? Because we have all sorts of things going on in the legal system. We have DNRs, which means do not resuscitate. We have all sorts of other abbreviations, alphabet soup abbreviations, let die a natural death. We have documents called living wills. Living wills are these forms that people fill out. I don't want to be kept alive by artificial means. We have powers of attorney. Now again, just as a matter of, just to be aware of the legalities, be aware that a living will and a durable power of attorney are two separate types of documents, although they're commonly done together. But they are two separate things. Let me just be sure that everyone understands the difference. A living will is, you know, again, the generic term for all of this is advanced directives. Advanced directives just means the stuff that you prepare when you're healthy, although a lot of times you do when you're in the hospital, kind of saying what should happen if you get sick. So a living will is a form of advanced directive that kind of specifies, in whole or in part, what types of interventions you want and what types of interventions you don't want. So you could specify all sorts of things. You could specify, I don't want CPR. I don't want my people to pound on my chest. I don't want whatever it is to be put on a respirator. You could even say, in most states, I don't want to be given artificial feeding if I cannot take nutrition by mouth. Even that is permitted, even though that means you're going to be effectively starving to death. You can say, I don't want blood thinners. I don't want dialysis. Now, you have to understand, obviously, that normally a living will is going to be important if you're unconscious, meaning as long as you're conscious and able, then in other words, if you say, I want dialysis, and they say, oh no, you signed a living will that you don't get dialysis. It doesn't work that way. In other words, you can always change your mind as long as you're competent and awake. But the living will kicks in if, God forbid, a person becomes unconscious in a coma, or if a person becomes mentally incompetent. So we follow the doctors, or so legally, doctors are supposed to follow the terms of the living will, which really allow almost everything except actual suicide. And they can't kill you, they can't, you know, shoot you, but almost every conceivable medical treatment can be stopped. Number one, it doesn't have to be started, but even if it was started, it can be stopped, including hydration and nutrition. Even though we might consider that starvation and suicide, but legally it is treated like a medical procedure. That is what is in a living will. In some living wills you can also include organ donation. If you want to donate an organ, you can stick that in as well. Okay, that is called a living will. Now, a power of attorney simply indicates that in the event I become incapacitated and unable to make healthcare decisions, I hereby designate the person who shall make these decisions for me. Now, this is a fairly important thing to do if, for whatever reason, your closest family members are not the people you want to make those decisions. In many cases, you don't have to designate somebody because the legal system will do it anyway. So a spouse will do it for a husband, and there's a hierarchy, you know, children, and etc. So if everybody's on the same page, you don't have to designate, although it's good to have, you know, a deciding voice. But if, for example, you are a religious person, and the person who would be making the decisions is not a religious person, you would not necessarily want them to make those decisions, because they may make decisions that are keneged halacha. They may authorize organ donation, or they may authorize stopping treatment when halacha says you're supposed to keep people alive. So when you have what's called a power of attorney, you can designate anybody you want. So if you have a sibling that's religious, you can designate them. Or it doesn't even have to be a family member. You can actually designate a rabbi. I don't mean a rabbi, no, you, a specific person who will be the one. Now, that's going to create a lot of tension, because if the family wants one thing and the rabbi says something else, there's going to be a lot of tension. But legally, even legally, the person in the power of attorney is the one that legally is empowered to make those decisions. Now, theoretically, I can do a power of attorney without doing a living will. And then the person who's designated has complete authority. Or I can do a living will without a power of attorney, in which case the person that the law will appoint as my agent will still have to obey the terms of the living will. These are two separate ideas. The living will specifies the steps that should be taken or not taken, and the power of attorney specifies the person who needs to be consulted to make decisions. Now, if there is a contradiction, for example, let's say the living will says no dialysis, but the attorney, meaning I don't mean the lawyer, the person who is in the power of attorney wants to do dialysis, technically speaking, the living will controls, because the living will is a limitation on the power of attorney. In other words, I use the attorney in the sense of the agent. Doesn't have to be a lawyer, of course. Maybe shouldn't be a lawyer. The attorney that's designated has to make their decisions consistent with the provisions of the living will. Okay? So it's important that you be aware of these different types of documents. Now, a Jewish organization, Agudas Israel of America, you may have heard of them, they publish a thing that you can get online called a halachic living will. And because every state has the different formalities of how you prepare it, you know, witnesses, you know, you have to really dot your I's and cross your T's, because every state has, you know, some states have witnesses, some states require notarization. See, so they prepared a form for every state in the United States. And this is called the Halachic Living Will. And really, in a way, they contradict what I just told you. Really, their document is not a living will, it's a power of attorney. They use the term living will in an incorrect way. But what the Agudah document says is the following. You designate a family member to be your agent, but you then state, it is my wish that all decisions be made in accordance with halacha. And you then indicate the rabbi who's not going to be, he's not the attorney per se, he does not actually make the healthcare decisions, but he is the rabbi whose psak halacha is going to be the basis of this. And then you indicate an alternative rabbi if this rabbi is not available. Right? So this is an important thing for people to have. Even when someone is young and healthy, you know, Baruch Hashem, unfortunately, tragedies do happen. And the decisions have to be made, so it's good to have this halachic living will. You can just Google halachic living will, and you'll be directed to the Agudas Israel forms. Okay, so collectively, these two documents, whether it's a living will or the power of attorney, are called advance directives, and there actually is a federal law that whenever a person is admitted to a hospital, for any reason, for an appendix or whatever it is, they have to advise you that you should, you don't have to make a living will then, but they have to advise you about a living will and give you their forms, which of course are not halakhic forms anyway, but they have to give you the forms that the hospital has. So this is a very, very important part of the healthcare system that you need to be aware of. Yeah.
In case of emergency, though, and everything happens so sudden, and you're taken to a hospital, who checks if you've signed the form anyway?
Yeah. So that's an interesting point. So the Agudah recommends the following. Agudah recommends that they make a miniature form. There's the big form, and then there's a miniature form that's in your wallet, and you keep it in your wallet. So in a hospital, generally, if a person comes in with a wallet, you know, they'll look at the wallet for any type of advance directive. For cash, yeah, right. Yeah, that too.
I'm looking for the advance directive.
Right. Yeah, so they do that. You know, in Israel also has advance directives, although their advance directive is horrendous. It's like 50 pages. It's very complicated. I tried to read it in English and in Hebrew, and it just seemed very contradictory to me. I could not make full sense of it either. Very confusing. But the one thing they have is this. This is very interesting, and this is because Israel is a centralized medical system, is you send it to the Ministry of Health, and it is entered in your medical record. And, you know, every doctor that's treating you has access to all of your medical records, so they immediately see by entering your Tudat Zehut. Like, you know that you've gone, if any of you have gone to a doctor, you know, they always want the Kartis Magenti, they want that magnetic card. To get anything in Israel, you got to present. Well, I'm not sure, maybe your
magnetic
students,
card?
Maybe it doesn't work for you. But if you're an Olef, if you're a citizen of Israel.
It's a healthcare card.
Yeah, healthcare card.
It's called. I don't have a healthcare card yet.
Okay. better get one.
I have a coupon.
Yeah, in other words, if you're enrolled in the Kupat Cholim, which is the national insurance, right? So everybody gets a card, like an ATM card, with a magnetic strip. So every time you go to a doctor, before the doctor will talk to you, you could be bleeding from the artery, whatever it is. Magnetic card, please, because they have to run that magnetic card through. It's very quick. Don't worry. I mean, even if you would die in 5 minutes, you'll have 4 minutes to spare. They'll
right. Depends
on right. 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 Yeah. Right. So with that magnetic card, they have immediate access to all of the medical tests you've taken in Israel, etc. So the way they would know in Israel, for sure, they would know you have an advance directive here, because it's already going to be on file with the Ministry of Health, assuming you sent it in. Some people don't send it in, and then there may be problems. Okay, so this is kind of the legal background of this, and you need to be aware of it, because in order to follow halacha, you may need to fill out these forms at some point in your life. But let me go over the halachas again. Some of this I said last week, but I want to elaborate and build on it and give you a few more examples so you understand the issue. Basically, if you recall, I said there are two approaches in the halachic system. One, I'm going to use English words for this, but this summarizes the gisha, the approach in halacha. One is called the vitalist system. Vitalist simply means the mitzvah of preserving life overrides everything else. In fact, on some level, this might even be our gut reaction, meaning we have a mitzvah to keep people alive as long as we possibly can, no matter how much pain they're suffering, no matter how much diminished quality of life. And I guess the virtue of this approach is it is consistent with the general idea that pikuach nefesh is the most important value in Judaism. We don't care if you're in a coma, we don't care if you're suffering, we don't care if you're screaming. Now, again, we have to do what we can in pain management, absolutely. But a person is mechuyav. Both the patient is obligated to want to live, and we are obligated to help the person live, whether they really want so or not. So we call this the vitalist position, which basically says we will do everything and anything to keep people alive, even if it's a very short time. If I can keep someone alive for another 3 minutes, I have to do it. And even if they're suffering, and even if they don't even want it. Now, legally, you can't do that against his will, but halachically, this is the obligation. Right, vitalist, yeah.
For a Jewish doctor, does that apply to his non-Jewish patients?
Okay, so that's a very excellent question. Vis-a-vis my non-Jewish patients, I am not allowed to actively terminate their life. But I don't have to aggressively sustain their life if they don't want it. So, in a sense, you're correct. The Jewish doctor does not have that many halachic complications vis-a-vis his non-Jewish patients. He can follow the law of the land. So, when we're talking about halacha, we are primarily talking about the Jewish physician's obligation towards his Jewish patients, even if they're not religious. Yeah. So that is a very excellent point. That makes it a lot easier if my patients are not Jewish. Okay. Now let me point out, though, I do want to mention that even under the vitalist position, there are things that you can do in the opposite direction. So I'm going to mention five or six exceptions to vitalism. Now remember, vitalism is the strictest position. And even within the strictest position, there are certain leniencies where, because of pain, you can do certain things. Exception number one, which you might not really call an exception, but it is an exception, prayer. You are allowed to pray that somebody should die. This is an explicit Gemara. that the great author of the Mishnah, remember the author of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, was suffering excruciating illnesses. It seems to sound like stomach cancer. That seems to be the thing that the Gemara is discussing. And he was screaming in agony. And all of the rabbis were praying that God should give him life, give him life, give him life. And his maid saw how much he was suffering. So she went in the middle of the Beis Medrash. She took a big vase and she smashed it. And when the vase smashed, everybody stopped praying for a moment because they didn't know what it was. And the second they stopped praying, the Malach HaMavis came and took him. As long as they were praying, the Malach HaMavis was not allowed to come in. She did something to make them stop praying so that he would die. Now, the Ran, a very, very famous commentator, Rabbeinu Nisim, he's called the Ran, he was a Spanish commentator, says that we see from here that although you're not allowed to kill somebody, but when you're dealing with what you might call supernatural phenomena, like stopping davening or the like, that you're allowed to do. And therefore, the Ran says, by the same token, the same way you could stop praying that somebody should live, you can actually pray that somebody would die, that God should take them out of their suffering. Now, some people have argued that this is a real inconsistency, because on one hand, you're telling me halachically, I got to do everything to keep this person alive. And then I ask Hashem, but Hashem, please do not give my efforts a success. I mean, normally, it's very, very bizarre to daven for something when you're doing exactly the opposite, because you're like going against your prayer. But this is what the vitalist position says. You got to do what you got to do, but you can pray that Hashem should override you. That's exception number one. Exception number two, which is very, very important, is pain relief that incrementally increases the risks of death. Let's say somebody has terminal cancer. And you want to give morphine or something that deadens the pain. Now, the truth of the matter is that any of these pain-killing medications can create a risk of stopping breathing or cardiac arrest or various other things if they're given in lethal doses. And the problem also is that even a non-lethal dose may accumulate, depending on how often the morphine pump is triggered. So this is what the Catholics call, they have a term which halacha can use as well, double effect. Double effect means the following. If the reason we're giving it is to control pain, even if it has the effect of possibly hastening death, if it is done for purposes, now only God knows, remember, it's very easy to be deceptive here. But let me just remind you that, you know, you can fool yourself and fool people, but you can't fool Hashem. Mm-hmm. So this is a test that very much depends on your own honesty. But you're not doing it to kill the person. And you're not giving a deliberately lethal dose, like some doctors do. But you're doing it for the purpose of controlling pain. So even if there is a risk that it may hasten death, it is permitted because it is not being given for suicide or murder, euthanasia. It's being given for pain relief. So this is a very, very important rule to know, that we can administer pain relief medications to terminally ill patients, even if it may cause them to die earlier, as long as our sole intention is to alleviate pain and not to cause death. Okay, that is exception number two. Remember, these are exceptions in the vitalist position, the strictest position. Exception number three. If the treatment itself is high risk, let's say that somebody has a gangrenous leg, God forbid, and if we don't amputate, the person will die. On the other hand, they would rather, now here's the thing, this is where vitalist position is very harsh. Under the vitalist position, if a person simply says, I would rather die with my leg than live with an amputation. Which, you know, makes sense. According to the vitalist position, remember, I'm going to give you another school of thought here. You still amputate the leg. Because if amputating leg will keep him alive, then even if he'll live without a leg, you do it. But, here's the exception. If because of his overall health and age and frailty, the amputation itself is risky. So if it works, he'll be alive without a leg. If it doesn't work, he may die on the operating table. He has the right to decline risky, dangerous medical procedures, even if it means he's certainly going to die, because maybe the procedure would have killed him earlier.
But you could say that about anything that where you have to be under and general anesthesia.
Yeah, so the question becomes, how significant the risk? Now, it's true. It is absolutely true that even if you're getting your tonsils out, do they still take tonsils out? I don't know.
Yeah,
yeah, okay. You know, a person can die at the operating table. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, those risks for a regular healthy person are very, very small. So you can't just say every surgery is, you know, risky. But when you're elderly and frail, you know, for example, and again, the post can discuss what exactly is the percentage, but we're talking about 50% risk, 30% risk, but it has to be a very significant risk, not a minimal risk. Okay, so that's exception number three, that you do not have to undertake life-threatening medical procedures to keep yourself alive if you don't want to. You could basically say, I'll let nature, so to speak, take its course. Okay, exception number four, one who is suffering the pain of a terminal illness does not have to utilize experimental unproven treatments. Right, sometimes new things come up, and if a person wants to live, he will seek out experimental treatment. But the halacha does not require you to be a guinea pig, and therefore, if you don't want to live, you have the right to say, I don't want to use experimental treatment, meaning you're only obligated to use medical procedures whose effectiveness has been established scientifically. Right? Again, you follow what I'm doing. I'm giving you, we're working within...
Even if there's no other option?
Even if there's no other option, that's correct. Now, if you want to, you should, but you don't have to.
The potential treatment, which is experimental, is so unsure that it can actually cause death, but it can also heal you. So
that's correct.
So what's your choice? Like, can you pursue that treatment, or
you can?
No. You are permitted. No. You are permitted to elect that procedure. But my point is, you're not obligated. See, here we're talking about we're addressing the perspective from the opposite side of the coin. Here, we're addressing the perspective: when can I, as a patient, say, I would rather die than take this med? If I want to be aggressive, I'm allowed to be aggressive. But here we're discussing the opposite, because the vitalist position says, we don't care about your pain, we don't care about your suffering, we have to keep you alive. So I'm indicating that there are certain cases where you have the right to say, I don't want to go further. Experimental. Now, let me mention a fifth issue that Rav Moshe Feinstein brings. And this is very tricky. This is sometimes hard for people to understand. Rav Moshe says there's a difference between being obligated to have medical treatment and being forced to have medical treatment. Rav Moshe says, yes, a patient is halachically obligated to try to stay alive as long as he can. But if he doesn't want to, we don't tie him down and force feed him and the like. In other words, he's obligated and we have to tell him he's obligated. But if he decides not, let's take the amputation as a good example. I told you, according to the vitalist position, if we tell a person, if we don't amputate your leg, you're going to die in a week. If we amputate your leg, you can live for 5 years. Now, I had mentioned, if the surgery is dangerous, you don't do it. But let's say it's not dangerous. In other words, he can live for 5 years. But he says, I would rather die now and not lose my leg. So I had mentioned under the vitalist position, we are supposed to amputate. But here is the subtlety. We tell the person, the halacha is, you should want to live, and we try to, you know, I don't mean this in a cold way, but you try to explain that life is so important. But if at the end of the day the person says, I don't care, we do not tie him down and amputate against his will. So this is a subtlety. Just because there is an obligation to do whatever you can doesn't mean we will physically put it on a person. And now, what's Rav Moshe's basis? Rav Moshe's basis is because to do medical treatment of this nature against a person's will may be so traumatic that it itself may be life-threatening. You may be making him suicidal in that particular way. So, which means, ultimately, in a sense, it is really the patient's decision. Meaning, even if halacha says he is obligated to be treated, we're not going to do it if he doesn't want. So it is the patient's decision, but I don't mean religiously it's the patient's decision. The patient is supposed to decide, I want it. Mm-hmm. But it's his decision in the sense that if he doesn't want it, we are not going to do it. Now let me point out, under American law, under Israeli law, it's obvious you can't do medical treatment against will. That's obvious. I mean, legally the doctor would get arrested for that, lose his license. But I'm referring to even halacha. Even if the law would let you get away with it, and nobody would know, halacha does not allow you to compulsorily deliver this type of treatment to somebody against his will. Now, that's not the same as minor things. Even though, I mean, for example, halacha certainly says I give blood transfusions against a person's will. I mean, that I'll do. But if you're talking about things like loss of a limb, whatever it is, paralysis, we don't do those things to people.
Why a blood transfusion and not a life or death?
No, blood transfusions can be a matter of life and death, but all I'm saying is it doesn't leave the person with the debilitating loss of function. Meaning, if a person starts...
A lot of force, them to do blood transfusion, it'll be painful?
Well, we're allowed to force a blood transfusion, we're not allowed to force an amputation. I mean, there is a difference. Blood transfusion is a blood transfusion. It's not leaving a person with half of his body gone.
Same person wants, like you said, but if it's up to the person about life or death, and the person wants it to die...
Yeah,
blood transfusion will keep them alive.
That's correct. But that, as I say, but that doesn't. I understand. But as I say, normally the mitzvah is. This is the vitalist position. Normally the mitzvah is to keep a person alive as long as we can. That's our mitzvah. It's overridden where the medical procedure itself will be devastating and traumatic to him. A blood transfusion is not devastating and traumatic in that sense. Yeah.
I have a question. Let's assume a scenario that the person was about to lose their leg, decides that they don't want to have it amputated, they prefer to die next, like,
yep.
You know, whatever the standpoint of halakha
right.
is.
Right.
But they're already so traumatized by the fact that they're going to lose that leg or
yeah.
a hand or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're depressed by the fact that they'll have to live without it.
Because it's a serious, certainly.
It's seriously very, very, very heavy on them anyway.
Yeah.
And you know that they're depressed when they're making a decision that they prefer to die than live without the leg.
Yeah.
What do you do then? Do you let them die or do you...
No. Again, I don't mean to imply that this is a single conversation. Mm-hmm. That Tuesday afternoon they said, I don't want the amputation, so we'll let them die. This is an ongoing process in which you have to, if there are depression issues, you know, you have to bring in therapists, you have to bring in spiritual counseling, prayer, and hopefully, you know, this will be a continuing discussion. Again, I'm simplifying things by making it sound like it's like, you know, a 1 minute question and answer. It isn't that at all. It's an ongoing process. But ultimately, halacha recognizes a certain concept of autonomy, but different than in the secular realm. This is an important, subtle point. In the secular realm, autonomy actually justifies and legitimates the decision. If a person decides they want to die, that is the right decision in a secular sense, because autonomy gives them that control. In halacha, it is the wrong decision, But even if it's the wrong decision, we don't force it, because that could be devastating. So we recognize autonomy de facto, I would say, but we don't recognize it de jure, if you get my Latin. In other words, autonomy is not a right to decline treatment, but it does mean we will not force it against the person's will, because that is itself traumatic, but we will try to encourage the person to do the right thing. And how you encourage, again, let me point out a lot of things. Okay, the case of amputation is a very, very hard case. It is a very hard case, because a person to live without a leg, without an arm, without a hand, I mean, this is an awful, awful thing. But we try, like anything else, we try to show people the potential of life, and perhaps there are milestones one has to be aware, like, you know, there may be a grandson getting married or somebody graduating college, and it's often the idea that people will live for these milestones and these accomplishments. I think I mentioned that even things like having a pet or taking care of a plant gives a person a reason to live. How can I die? You know, who will take care of my dog? You know, whatever it is. You ever see? They bring now. They bring these pets to the therapeutic pets. They're so cute. They have an ID around their neck with a picture ID and a paw print. You know, and the leg. Yeah.
If I'm in a position where I've been granted power of attorney for my mother, who, for whatever reason, is very ill, and she's in this position where she needs her leg amputated.
Yeah.
She has been.
I'm sorry. This is actually the position that she's in, right?
No.
Oh, God. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah. You're asking me theoretically. You're asking me theoretically.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay. No. You're asking me theoretically. Okay,
she's healthy. Thank
yeah,
God.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. I'm using it because
it should continue. Yeah.
This is where I might have the issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I've tried to convince her of, you know, what she's obligated to do.
Yes.
She has made her decision. She's not having it amputated. The doctors have heard it. They've agreed to it. And then she falls into a coma.
Yep.
If I have power of attorney, I can reverse it.
Yes. So this is a very excellent question. Because remember that Rav Moshe's analysis is based on why don't we force the amputation? Because forcing the amputation is so traumatic that itself might be a life-threatening procedure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that's the argument, if that's the svara, that's the reasoning, paradoxically, when someone's in a coma, and they don't necessarily suffer that trauma...
Which she wakes up from the coma without a...
So this would depend. This would depend. Meaning to say, if there is a reasonable likelihood that she may come out of the coma,
mm-hmm.
then I would apply Rev Feinstein's rule and don't do the amputation.
Okay.
If, on the other hand, the medical consensus, which might be wrong, but you have to work with what you know,
mm-hmm.
is that she's not going to come out, then paradoxically, see, it's a little counterintuitive. You sometimes have to be more aggressive treating people in comas than people who are awake. That the coma person, who may not feel any traumatic invasion, you actually have to try to keep them alive, mm-hmm. because you don't have the counterbalancing,
mm-hmm.
right? So that would be the difference. In other words, you would have to ask the doctor, what are the chances that she will come out of this coma and discover that her leg was amputated? If the doctor says she's not coming out, again, things, it might be wrong, but if that's the judgment,
mm-hmm.
then I have a mitzvah to keep her alive no matter what. If she'll come out, then I have to say, well, there's a mitzvah to keep her alive, but since I know this will be extremely devastatingly traumatic for her when she awakes, then I have to respect her decision, right? That's how you would analyze it.
What if it's imminent danger? What if her leg needs to be amputated during a week?
But if she already made the decision...
But she'll wake up in about a week and a half. But if that leg isn't amputated within a week, she'll die.
Well, again.
She's going to wake up in a week.
Again, but she's gonna wake up, and the point basically is you don't assault her in a way that will cause death. Your argument is, but she'll die later than she would because of the leg. That's a very interesting question. I have to think about it. If she'll die earlier because of the non-amputation, then she'll die because of the amputation. Then do the amputation, even if that causes her to die, because she's going to live another week. That's a very excellent question. But I think, Even so, halacha differentiates between letting somebody die and doing something that kills them, meaning doing something is worse than not doing something. Although it's true, I understand philosophically, inaction is a form of action, but in halacha...
Falling into a depression doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to take their life.
That's true, but you're doing an overt act that may... By the way, Moshe doesn't suggest he's going to commit suicide. I mean, it may just refer to the body itself. The adrenaline, in other words, she may go into cardiac arrest, in other words, the stress to the system of the devastating trauma may hasten a person's death. He's not necessarily suggesting she take a knife and, kill herself in that way. But that, again, that is a very, very excellent question. You see that these are complicated issues. But again, all of this is within a single paradigm, which is only 50% of the halakhic school. And this is called the vitalist school. The vitalist school basically says that except for risky treatment and forcing people and pain relief and prayer, you do have to keep people alive no matter what. And even though we don't physically force it on them, but we do tell them, this is your obligation. You have an obligation to go through this and the like. Now, let me mention, though, that this is only one half of the equation. There is a whole other shita. Shita means approach. A whole other shita in halacha that is associated with some very, very great rabbis, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, and even Rav Moshe Feinstein, that basically says there are situations where there is no mitzvah to aggressively keep people alive. But their conditions are very, very precise.
What position are we calling it?
What should we call it? The non-vitalist position? I don't know if I have a good... or I would say maybe the pain and suffering balance. Or pain and suffering mitigation, meaning... Mm-hmm. That because of pain and suffering, we sometimes don't have to go full steam ahead.
The other position.
The which one?
The other position.
The other position.
That's what I'm calling it.
That's such an elegant title. Okay. The other. Okay. Sorry, I didn't think of that. Okay. Now.
It was too long. That's why.
Wait, was it pain and suffering? Mitigation.
I don't have a tremendously good name for it, but you can call it what you like, but I called it the pain and suffering mitigation. And again, this is it's most associated with Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. I've mentioned him before. I don't know if you've heard of him. He was Nifter around 25 years ago. He was a great, great gadol in Yerushalayim. He was really, truly, truly great posek, but he also was a very, very beloved person who everybody loved. And in fact, people say there was not a single picture of him without him smiling. He was always, he certainly fulfilled the mitzvah of greeting and talking to everybody, always b'sever panim yafos, with a very pleasant countenance. But he has a number of conditions. I'm going to give you a list. This list is very important. If and only if the following conditions exist, there is no obligation to keep people alive. Condition number one. Now these are not or, this is and. So you need all of these conditions. Condition number one, the patient, even with treatment, will survive for a year or less. Meaning this is called temporary life. This corresponds really with terminal illness in many definitions, meaning to say, no matter what you know, again, we know Hashem does miracles, but obviously in these areas of halacha, we do depend on medical judgments. Now, if the doctors are divided, you have to be strict and assume the person will live more than a year. But if the unanimous opinion, checking with many, many opinions, is that no matter what you do, you're dealing with short-term duration. There's a term for short-term life. Short-term life is called chayei sha'a, which literally means life of an hour, but it means temporary life, which is defined, based on some other halachic sources, as a probable life expectancy of less than a year, no matter what you do. Okay? Number two. Now, one second. Chayesha in the abstract, you still have to prolong. That's not an issue. If it was just a question of, do I have to keep somebody alive who will just live another week, or another day, or another minute? The answer is yes. But Chayesha permits me to balance other things. So condition number one is a unanimous diagnosis that his life expectancy is less than 1 year, no matter what you do.
This is a subcategory of Chayesha.
No. That's what Chayesha means. That's category. That's one. Okay. Number two, the person is undergoing extreme pain and suffering. Now,
what standard?
Well, pain and suffering, again, it's a little problematical. This is not as simple as it is, because pain has both physical components, mm-hmm. right? For example, a person with multiple sclerosis, just to give you an example, there is kind of a random, it's like almost like a state of electric shock. There's random firing of neurons. You feel, people describe it, they feel like their body is on fire. Literally, it's electrical sparks. Not sparks, but electrical impulses. Or there could be cancers, there could be excruciating pain, pancreatic, any cancer really, and the like. So there's now, but in addition to physical pain, things get complicated. There is a psychological component of pain that depends on the brain and not necessarily the nervous system. If somebody's a quadriplegic, or somebody has Lou Gehrig's disease, they don't necessarily feel pain. You stick a needle in there, there may not be a reaction. But the pain of people in that circumstance is not the pain of nerves bringing things to the brain, but it's the psychological devastation of being locked in and not responding and not being able to function. Some legal philosophers, you know the phrase pain and suffering, they have actually wanted to differentiate by saying that pain is a physiological response, and suffering is the emotional, mental anguish that a person has. Now in halacha, I had thought that halacha only recognized physical, did not necessarily look at psychological anguish. But I see that in more recent psakim, the poskim have recognized, under Rav Orbach's test, they have recognized psychological anguish as well. But this is severe. Now, severe is not a clear definition. If you go to a pain clinic or a hospital, they will often give you, I don't know, hopefully you should never see this and never experience this, but they will show you a chart of faces, frowning faces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you can easily just pick the left
one. Yeah, well, of course, everybody could. But most of the time people want to pick the right one because mm-hmm. they want to get the right medication. I mean, they don't want to, you know, be knocked out into a coma, you know, for some extreme point. So you actually rate your pain in different ways. And the truth of the matter is, pain management is a much more sophisticated, or palliative medicine, as it's called, is a much more sophisticated specialty. Baruch Hashem, it really is a very, very important branch of medicine, as long as they don't move into euthanasia, which sometimes they do in hospices and the like. But the notion of helping people control pain has made major, major progress. But sometimes, in comparatively rare cases, because there's a tremendous amount they can do with pain, both conventionally and even with alternative things, whether it's acupuncture or imaging or hypnosis, a lot of stuff they can do. But if at the end of the day the pain is uncontrollable, or psychologically the person's locked in or something and they feel the anguish of incapacity, that's factor two. So again, I'm giving you a list and then we'll go back. So number one, no matter what you do, you're talking about Chayesha. Number two, there's uncontrollable pain and suffering. Number three, the patient has indicated that they would rather die than continue in this pain and suffering. Okay, now I'll talk about what if they're unconscious, but let's assume they're awake. So Rav Orbach said, if three conditions are met, Okay, again, the three conditions are chayesha, uncontrollable pain, which includes physical as well as psychological, and three, the patient has indicated. Now, if they want to live, that's go ahead and do it, of course. But they have indicated they would rather die than bear this pain. Rav Orbach says there is no mitzvah to try to keep them alive. They have the right to make that decision. Now, this is a very, very important. This is very different than the vitalist decision. Now, going back, let's say, to the amputation example. Well, okay, before I get to examples, let me just mention, though, that even in Rav Orbach's halachic reasoning, there are two major exceptions you need to know. These are exceptions where you have to preserve life. That is, Rav Orbach said, although you do not have to keep people alive, there are certain things you have to give them whether they want it or not. You have to give them nutrition, and that includes not only nutrition by mouth, but it even includes tube feeding, because you cannot starve a person to death. Now, there's an exception to the exception. Even that is not true at the very, very, very end of life. Because what happens, I'm talking about when death is virtually imminent. Because at the very end of life, the body is already shutting down. It cannot process nutrients. If it cannot process nutrients, if you try to give a person nutrition, you may kill them faster. Right, so we're not talking about that, but we're talking about as long, according to Rav Orbach, as long as the body can process the nutrients, you must give it to them. So that's food, hydration is hydration, water. Again, either by mouth or by intravenous. And the third is you must provide oxygen. Now that doesn't necessarily mean putting them on a ventilator, I'll discuss that, or a respirator. But you must provide them the breathing, because air starvation is essentially a form of starvation. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that's an important exception. Even in the case of chaye sha'a, with great pain, and the patient wants to die, this is very different than secular law. Secular law says they have the right to decline hydration, nutrition, and oxygen. Halacha says we must give it to them. So that's an exception to Rav Shlomo Orbach's three rules. There's a second exception, which is extremely important, but very complicated. Although you don't have to aggressively keep them alive, you're not allowed to do active euthanasia. Okay, this is the distinction where you can withhold, but you can't actively terminate. Now, you understand that the active versus passive is simple in some cases, and it's complicated in others. For example, let me give you a simple example. If you have a patient who has been given a diagnosis, he has advanced pancreatic cancer, and he has been given a diagnosis that even with chemotherapy, he will die in 6 months. But without chemotherapy, he will die in 3 months. Is he halachically obligated to undergo chemotherapy if the pain of either the cancer or the chemo or both is so extreme that he says he would rather die? So, like the vitalist physician, although we wouldn't force him to get the chemo, we would tell him, halacha says, you must take the chemo because you're going to buy 3 months of life. Under Rav Orbach's analysis, we would say, number one, chaye sha'a. Number two, extreme uncontrollable pain. Number three, he'd rather die. We don't have to give him chemo. In other words, put it another way, he doesn't have to take it. But that's clearly passive. We're not giving him the chemo that could keep him alive for 3 months. Now, the opposite, what would clearly be active? To take an example which you can't do, the guy says, kill me, give me a lethal dose of morphine to take me out, a lethal dose of morphine to take me out of my misery. Can't do that because Rav Shlomo Zalman is not permitting mercy killing, right? So that's a clear case of the difference between active and passive. We can't actively cause a person to die earlier, but we don't have to aggressively keep them alive if you meet these three criteria of chaye sha'a, uncontrollable pain, and a desire to die. But there are other cases where the active-passive is not so clear. For example, let's take a respirator. Now, we don't have to put people on a respirator, right? We can use these criteria not to put them on a respirator. Mm-hmm. But what if somebody's already on a respirator? Mm-hmm. Can we disconnect the respirator? Do I say, once he's on the respirator, shutting off the respirator is doing an action that is killing him? Can't do that. Or do you say, no, I'm not killing him, it's not like a morphine injection, I'm just removing the thing that's keeping him alive, mm-hmm. and he's dying because of his illness. I didn't introduce anything into his body. Right? Is it active or is it passive? Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein ruled many, many years ago that shutting off a respirator that a person is already on is treated as an active murder. And therefore, none of the pain laws, no, Rav Shlomo Zalman's criteria are not going to work. But there are other opinions that look at it as a passive withholding. Certainly, they've said, if the respirator in the olden days, it doesn't happen anymore, but what they do, what they do in Israel is this. Listen to this. They put the respirators on a Shabbos clock. Meaning, every 8 hours, every 10 hours, I don't know how many hours, whatever they want to set it for, it shuts off for 5 minutes. And then the family can be consulted, because once it's off, you can disconnect it. In other words, you can't just indiscriminately, but then you can apply these rules of suffering and the like, because shutting it off while he's actually breathing, it might be an act of murder, but when it's off, then my decision is, do I keep him attached? That's a passive withholding of reconnecting him. Okay. Or, let me give you another example. This is almost macabre, it's almost a science fiction thing. What they have for heart patients, either transplant patients or even people who have their own hearts, they actually put in defibrillators. They call pacemakers. These are pacemakers, meaning what happens is that if the heart's rhythm stops, the pacemaker gives a shock that starts it up, and it's actually implanted in the chest. But they give patients a machine, some patients, in which they can deactivate the defibrillator, meaning to say what they tell the patient is, you know, if at any particular point, you know, you'd rather not go on, just push the button and the defibrillator will turn off.
Can you turn the tub again, just in case?
Yes. That's not the one. Actually, this reminds me of a Twilight Zone, but I won't go over it right now. But yeah. You can turn it on and off, but you know. All right. Now.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah. That's right. But you know, in other words, it gives the patient control. Does he want it? Does he not want it? Now, it's very, very interesting. Now, obviously, let me put it this way. If the patient has an active heart attack and he shuts off the defibrillator while he's in the heart attack, that is an act of murder, because without that defibrillator, he's going to die. But if his heart is functioning fine, then the activation of the defibrillator is really the same thing as saying, I don't want to be connected to the respirator. So many poskim have said that if it's chaye sha'a and he's suffering and he doesn't want to live, he would be permitted to deactivate the defibrillator, because that's not an active... In other words, he's not actively killing himself. He's just turning off a device that may provide medical effectiveness at some future date.
But isn't that prospective, active involvement?
So this is where the active and the passive is very, very tricky. It's not active in the sense that it's automatically hastening your demise. Mm-hmm. In a sense, it's you're just saying, I don't want it to be there when I need it. That's like saying, I don't want the respirator. In other words, it's not working right now. It's not doing. Right now, the pacemaker is not keeping you alive. In other words, the pacemaker, or at least the defibrillator, is only going to kick in when the heart rhythm stops. So if it's not doing anything for you right now, it's simply discontinuing a treatment that's not being provided. Right? Even feeding. Now, I had mentioned anyway we're supposed to do feeding, but there is an issue about if you discontinue feeding, is that actively starving somebody, or is that simply not filling up the bag and doing a new thing, right? In other words, the point of active versus passive is not as simple. Again, there are simple cases. Not giving me chemotherapy is passive. Giving me lethal morphine is active. Right? There are simple cases where clearly one is active and one is passive. There are going to be cases where it's not so clear if it's active or passive. Turning off a respirator, deactivating a defibrillator, all of these different things. These are going to be tricky issues. Even dialysis is a very good example. Someone's on dialysis. Let's say this. Let's say the person has multiple organ failure. Even with dialysis, he'll stay alive for another year. Or let's say 10 months. Without dialysis, he'll die in 3 months. The pain, the suffering, the anguish, the lack of mobility, you know, dialysis, sometimes have to sit in a chair for 7 hours a day, is too much for him. Person says, I'd rather die. So here's the thing. According to Rav Orbach, can he decline dialysis? Yes, he can. It fits the criteria. Chayei sha'ah, suffering and anguish, he wants to die. So he has the right to decline dialysis. But let's say he started dialysis. Can he discontinue? Now, this is tricky. He comes in Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. He had dialysis on Monday. He says he doesn't want to come in on Tuesday. In a sense, that's just passive. Now, there's the same way he could have said, I don't want to start dialysis. He's saying the same thing. I don't want to do Tuesday's dialysis. Or do you say, once he started, it's considered like an ongoing treatment, and this is actively interrupting that? See, I'm not giving you an answer, but it is, you know, these are questions. This is based on the active versus passive. It seems to me quite logical, as a matter of logic, that dialysis is not continuous. It's not like interrupting a ventilator. The ventilator, he's attached to a ventilator. You're shutting it off, you're doing something that's killing him. Here, every session is a distinct session. If I have the right to decline any dialysis, then I have the right to decline the next session. So it would seem, would it not, I think, that we would treat dialysis as every intervention is a new separate intervention. And because it's a new separate intervention, we can apply Rav Shlomo Zalman's three criteria to every single dialysis session. That if it's chayei sha'ah and pain, you have the right to say no. So the idea that once a treatment starts, you can't interrupt it is not entirely true. It's true for something that's continuously keeping me alive, like a ventilator. It won't be true for discrete things, that each one is a separate event. There, we would look at each event as a new decision to take it or not to take it. Okay? So, bottom line is, I think a person would be allowed, based on Rav Shlomo Zalman's criteria, to elect not to continue with dialysis. Yeah.
Okay, this is an actual real situation.
Yeah.
My dad has an artificial heart valve.
Yeah.
So he has to take Coumadin, a blood thinner.
Yes.
For it. So if he were in one of these situations, you can't stop the valve. There's like it's mechanical. Would he have the option to not take his Coumadin for that day, and just to stop taking the Coumadin?
So, well, now again, this depends on if you remember. This
is, meets all.
Yeah, yeah.
The
you have to meet these criteria. This is not an indiscriminate permission.
Right. No,
yeah.
He meets all the criteria. Would it be acceptable to stop?
I believe so. because every time you take another dose of medicine, that's a new decision that you're being made. The fact that you took it for 5 years, that has nothing to do with whether I'm going to take it now. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think it would qualify. Okay.
Could you also look at dialysis and taking medication as series, as continuous treatment? So even though every single day you make another decision to undergo the same treatment, but it's part of the continuous program.
What you're saying is a reasoning that some post-com have used. Yes, 100%. I don't mean to present my view as the only view. It seems to me it's more logical to look at everything as new, but there is a position that says once you're enmeshed in a certain regimen, that becomes what's keeping you alive, and discontinuing it is an active euthanasia. That's right. All I'm saying is that in halacha, active versus passive is not pashut. It is not a simple question. The Rav has to be very, very familiar with exactly what is going on in the life. Now, let me just end with one final issue about this. That is, again, what is Rav Orbach's three? Remember, this is the big three criteria. Chayei sha'a, uncontrollable pain, and the patient has expressed his wish that he wants to die. Here's the problem. The third one can sometimes be a problem. What if the patient is unconscious? What if the patient has not expressed his wish to die? And let me point out, even if he expressed it in a living will that was written 2 years ago, that is not really relevant, halakhically. Because the issue is not what he thought 2 years ago. The issue is, what would he think now? Now, one answer might be, hey, by definition, if he's unconscious, he's not suffering, but he's not suffering the pain. Now, just remember that the issue is the pain, right?
Maybe. You can sometimes read the brain scan.
So this is a very tricky issue that science does not have definitive conclusions, especially when you consider the locked-in phenomenon and the like, and if you consider psychological anguish to be pain, and that is, we honestly don't have a full understanding of what people in different types of comas experience. The word coma, is a generic word, but it actually embraces a very big spectrum of different types of conditions of being semi-awake and totally out and locked in. And we use the word coma in a very, very vague sense. But I guess the halachic issue that a post would have to determine is, what would the patient want? But more than that, but it's not just what he would want, meaning, and is he suffering pain? Because I do want to emphasize, please be sure you understand this, the notion that the patient's desires has any relevance is only in conjunction with the pain that he's suffering, psychological or physical. If you factor out the pain, even Rav Orbach would say, we have to keep people alive. So when I'm contrasting the vitalist position and the pain and suffering mitigation, I guess my title was good for that purpose. Rav Orbach is also a vitalist. Halacha is a vitalist system. But Rav Orbach says the pain and the suffering can override it. So paradoxically, this leads to the conclusion that if a person in a coma does not have that pain, we would have to be more aggressive in keeping them alive than we would for somebody that is conscious and is suffering. Okay, but as I say, it's extraordinarily complicated because I don't think we can make any assumptions as to what people in comas feel. Now, perhaps we could measure neurological pain responses and the like, but we can't really measure total awareness. And if you factor in psychological anguish, then that awareness could certainly amount to that awful anguish. I mentioned the locked-in phenomenon last week and the like. Okay? So this is a complicated area, and it is a very complicated area. Medical science can keep people alive a lot longer than they used to, but as a result, halacha has to deal with the pain and the suffering and what you do about it and the like. So in many ways, the hospice movement is a very, very good, very, very good movement. It helps people psychologically get ready for death, to make amends, to kind of reestablish relationships. It does some very, very beautiful things. But sometimes, in their interest to help people, the expression they use is die well. They de-emphasize the imperatives of trying to keep people alive. Mm-hmm. And that is why halachically, there is much in hospice that is very, very problematical. They're a little bit too easy.
Well, yeah, when you're in hospice, you're done trying
to
live.
Yeah, that's right. Some hospices don't even allow artificial, tube feeding, nutrition, and the like.
Oh, wow.
They don't allow it. They say when it's time, we'll put ice chips on your lips, and that's about it. So, again, as I say, they do psychologically very, very wonderful work. But I think in a halachic sense, they don't have enough respect for the idea of life itself. So there are some Jewish hospices that try to incorporate both halacha and the psychological support systems of hospice. And again, that's something that the Jewish community can really benefit from, and it's a good thing to pursue.
Cost twice as much.
That's true. You're right. What do they say? Jews never buy retail. What do they say? Okay. Anyway. So be as it may, but I hope that, God willing, all of this should just be totally theoretical, and with the coming of the Mashiach, the sickness and the suffering should vanish from the earth.
Amen.
Okay. So you all take care. Have a good week.
Thank you. Okay.